you all tonight. Thankful for your presence. If you're visiting with us, we're honored to have you. Hope your time with us will be well spent. If you have your Bible, I invite you to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. We'll pick up there this evening and continue our study of this great book. Chapter 5 began with an admonition about being careful about worshiping God and how you go about your worship before God. He talks about the idea of being one who does not offer the sacrifice of fools. And in the context here, the opposite of offering the sacrifice of fools is to draw near to hear. This principle is repeated throughout the Old Testament. God would rather have obedience than sacrifice. Sacrifice was such a big part of the Old Testament life that at times people begin to think that sacrifice was all that mattered. And so as long as you were sacrificing, then God would be happy with you. Well, there are a number of episodes in the Bible where we see that wasn't true. When King Uzziah usurped the authority of the priests and went into the temple to burn incense, he was struck with leprosy. King Saul, when he usurped the authority of the priesthood and offered a sacrifice, Samuel told him, God was not pleased with you. God would rather have obedience than sacrifice. Other passages in the Old Testament, Isaiah chapter 1, they were making sacrifices and they were doing it right and they were offering the right thing at the right time, but their hearts weren't right. He said, your hands are full of blood. They were immoral people. So God said, I don't want your sacrifice. I want you to obey my other laws. Don't steal. Don't commit adultery. Don't murder. Don't cheat your neighbor. Things like that. You've not done those things, but you sacrificed. Well, I don't want your sacrifices. Or Malachi chapter 1, where the writer Malachi says, you offer the blind, the lame, as sacrifice to God. Offer it to your governor. Would he accept it? So there they were offering sacrifices, but not the best they had. So sacrifice was not enough. And there's an analogy that certainly would apply to us. Is there's instructions God has given us as his people today that we think if we get that done, then we've got everything done. If we've been baptized, then we've got everything done. If I come to church Sunday morning and Wednesday, I've got everything done. But there's much more to living for Jesus than just showing up at this building and getting in that water. And we understand that. And so the principle is you be careful when you come to the house of worship. You be ready to obey. Listen and obey. That's more important than sacrifice. And he talked about being careful with our words. Don't be rash. God hears everything you say. He's in heaven. And when you make a vow, you better be ready to pay it. God has no pleasure in fools who vow and do not pay. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. And do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, he says. Now, picking up in verse 8, I want us to pick up there and read together. Verse 8, he says, if you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of injustice and the righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter, for high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all. Even the king is served from the field. Now, I tell you one thing that kind of strikes me when you read through the book of Ecclesiastes, it is not written in a flowing manner at times. I mean, he moves right from talking about being careful about when you go to the house of God, walk prudently, do not be rash with your mouth. If you make a vow to God, you better pay that vow. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. And then he seems to completely change subjects about the poor and the oppressed and how righteousness is perverted. Beginning here in verse 10, he'll change subjects again. And it's almost to me, as I read this, it's like someone making entries into a diary. And it's not a flowing thought. You know, one day you got something on your mind and you write about it. And because you're upset or you moved by it or you saw something, it reminds you, and so you write about it. And then the next day, maybe you're upset about something you saw or something that happened or something that happened during the day, and you write about it. And then the next day, that's kind of how it's written here. And you see this throughout the chapters. It's not always a singular flowing thought that comes to his mind. He talked about oppression a couple of chapters earlier, about how the poor was mistreated and how they were oppressed, and he didn't understand, couldn't make that make sense in his mind and why those things came to be. And so you see this kind of unorthodox way of putting together his thoughts, but it would be like if you wrote something about your day today, and if you went into your diary tomorrow, your journal, and you wrote about your day tomorrow, it's going to be completely different, or it might be similar, or about some of the same things, but it might not be the same thing at all. But I bet you if I looked at someone's writings over a long period of time, I would see some of the same concerns throughout your life here that you'd see, or something that happened. about your experience here that was significant to you. Whether it be something good that you saw people do, and you may see it over and over again that people do for others, and you write about it when you see it. So it may show up several times in your entries. And so that's kind of how it's written here. And so he does kind of change subjects here. He goes from going to the house of God. Now he talks about the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province. And that's something that's been kind of going on from the beginning of time, I suppose, too. As long as there have been people of authority and exercising that authority over others, it's been difficult to find it to play out in a way in which all things are just and measured. Certainly sometimes they are not, and it's concerning him. But he says, when you see that happening, when you see oppression of the poor, those who have the least position to fight for themselves, and when you see righteousness and justice perverted in a province, his encouragement to you, or his admonition to you, is don't marvel at this. Don't be surprised by this. And then he gives the reason why. What's the reason why? For a high official does what? Watches over high official. And what's that high official do? Now, what do you think that means, Rex? They got each other's back. They're looking out for each other. And so that's how perversion of justice comes, is you've got people in positions of authority who are all corrupt. And so the ones who's supposed to be watching over a situation, he's corrupt. And the man is supposed to be watching over him to make sure he's doing it right, he's corrupt. One thing that's shocking to me, and I'm not accusing anybody of being corrupt, certainly, but it's shocking to me, is that, what's a Congress? Congress makes 145,000, it used to be 127, I think they raised to $145,000 a year. Seemed like a pretty good bit of money. But he has to run for office every 2 years. He has to raise $50 million to run for an office for every 2 years that pays $145,000. And then he has to maintain two places to live. He's got to maintain a place in Washington to live, and he's got to, wherever he's from, he's got to keep a house there. Maybe vote it out next year, you know. So he's maintaining two houses, one of which is in the highest rent district in the world, Washington, D.C. And he's living on $145,000 a year. And if he's up there for 15 to 20 years, when he comes out, he's got $65 million in the bank. You know how that happened? Charles Rangel was a congressman from Harlem, New York. Very, very wonderful story. Charles Rangel came from nothing. And sent himself through school, sent himself through college. His first election, he was elected as an alderman there in New York City, in Harlem. Worked in the public area of that city for many, many years. Then he ran for Congress. He was elected to Congress. He served in this Congress for 30 years. Came from nothing. And when he retired, you know, he's worth $47 million, making $145,000 a year. Now, you know, Ray Charles see through that. Somebody, you know, where's all that money coming from? I don't know. I'm not accusing them of being corrupt, but maybe they get it without being illegal, but I'm telling you, that money just has a tremendous amount of influence on people. And so he says, don't marvel that the people in charge, you can't find somebody to hold someone accountable because they're all kind of in it together. That's the point he's making here. Look at the next verse. This verse is a little bit challenging too. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all. Even the king is served from the field. Is it a good thing or a bad thing to have a king? Okay. He told Samuel, they haven't rejected you, they've rejected me. They want a king, I'll give them a king. One day I'll take him away in my wrath. And he did, didn't he? I guess it depends on the king and how he conducts himself. There, we talk about the children of Israel having having good kings and bad kings. Well, actually, when they divided, Israel didn't have any good kings, but Judah had good and bad kings. What do you think he means when he says, moreover, the profit of the land is for all? Is that true or false? Well, it should be, right. Should be. The ideal situation is that we're all in this together. We all need this place to succeed. Everybody lives off the land and must live off the land. We must live off the poor. Even the king is not exempt from that. He's got to live off the same thing the poor man's got to live off of. And I think he's given us kind of a push toward the ideal. It's looking at the situation where all of us are in this together. We all must live off the land in which we live. And so if you take the position where I'm going to get mine and not worry about anybody else, even the king will be without. And so the king, too, must live off the land. We all have a role to play. But when you think about the idea of a higher official watches over a higher official, and higher official watches over him, who is it that watches over all? God. So you don't have to concern yourself with trying to straighten all that out. God sees and knows and understands. All right, any questions or comments? Because we're going to change gears here in verse 10. All right, so now he's got a new subject. He introduces to you here in verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This is also vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. For what profit have owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There is severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked he shall he return to go as he came. He shall take nothing from his labor which he may carry away in his hand. Again, this also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, he shall go. And what profit has he who labored for the wind? All his days also he eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Now, if you had to summarize the section that we just read, how would you summarize that section? All right. What Job said, naked came out from my mother's womb, naked I shall return. That's a good way to summarize it. How else may you summarize? If he's going to put it on a T-shirt, what would it say? I see this on you see this statement sometimes, bumper stickers. Finish the sentence for me. Let's say make it easier for you. Finish this sentence for me. Blank cannot make you happy. Huh? Money. Money. That's how I'd summarize this. That's how it begins. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. Some people are just driven by the chase, not by what they receive, but by the chase. He who loves abundance, he won't be satisfied with increase. I saw a shirt one time that said, "They say money can't buy you happiness." And on the back of the shirt it said, "Try me." But people tend to think, you know, people who say that have got it. That's why they don't think it can buy you happiness. The truth of the matter is that many, many people who've got money will tell you exactly what this man is telling you, who had a lot of money. More silver, more gold than anybody that we know of, if this is Solomon, whom I believe it to be. That he had all those things, and he had them in spades. He had them in abundance, and they did not satisfy him. Over and over again, he comes back to the same thought. These things don't make us happy. In fact, he said there's some trouble that comes along with riches and wealth that don't concern yourself if you don't have any. He says, verse 11, now this is true. Wow. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. I was watching a documentary. It's been two or three years ago now, about a running back named Marcus Dupree. Anybody remember Marcus Dupree? Greatest running back who ever lived. And there was a documentary about him that said the greatest that never was. It's one of those 30 by 30 ESPN things. And it's kind of a touching, emotional thing. He was a poor kid from Philadelphia, Mississippi, but went to Oklahoma and was an amazing, amazing talent. And had a bunch of terrible people around him, giving him terrible advice, pulling at him, tugging at him, and he wasn't equipped to deal with all that, taking his money from him. He still lives in Mississippi today, and he drives a truck for RSC Rentals. He drives a big over-the-road rig, which ain't nothing wrong with that. But the first contract he signed with the USF team for $5 million. And he said he saw $45,000 of that $5 million. That's all he ever saw, because other people was handling his money. And it disappeared. It disappeared. Said he was riding by. One of the things, there was a church building where there was a monument built to some civil rights workers, and it said it was donated by Marcus Dupree. He didn't know nothing about it. He said, you know, I didn't realize I donated that. Well, that's good, you know. But he said everybody came out of the woodworks because they thought I was rich now because I had money. And so it just was no end to it. And he said it was miserable to him. He said, I was so much happier when I didn't have any. And there's a lot of people who understand that sentiment here. But the principle, the point he's making is a point that he'll come back to in time again, is that riches are one thing, it is fleeting. There's no lasting enjoyment in those things. And ultimately, what happens to whatever you have, what happens to it? Somebody else is going to have it one day. And you're going to leave just like you came into this world without anything. And all he's trying to encourage us to do is have the proper attitude toward these things. I was trying to think of how somebody put it one time. I was in a Bible class, and this lady said, it's okay for us to have possessions as long as our possessions don't have us. I thought that was pretty good. All right, let's look at verse 18. He says, so in this verse 18, he kind of changes gears a little bit too, but here's a summary statement. And this is a summary statement he makes several times. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor, in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God gives riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. Now, who is introduced to the story here in verse 18, 19, and 20 that's missing in verses 10 through 17? Who? God. And so I want you to notice that we've talked about this before. When he's trying to figure all this out on his own, he is miserable. Life, it never makes sense to him. When he's saying, I'm going to figure this out, what's the meaning of life, what's the purpose of life, what I'm supposed to be doing here. And whenever God is not a part of those discussions, in every chapter, he says this is vanity. This is the grasping for the wind. But when he introduces God into the story, he finds peace. He finds joy. He finds a reason for living, whether you got much or little. He says, so what I conclude? Man, just live every day. Enjoy what you have. Look at it as a gift from God. Be blessed by that. And then just take one day at a time. And that's a sentiment that's also repeated throughout the scriptures. The idea of us being careful about thinking too much ahead, thinking too much about the future. And so he says in verse 20, for he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life. Why? Because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. And the joy of his heart here is appreciating the fact that he has what he has because God has given it to him. And he's just going to live one day at a time enjoying those things that God has given him. All right, any questions or comments here? Because I want to get into chapter 6 to kind of stay on my course here. Any questions or comments? No questions, no comments. That can only mean one thing, Sam. I've done an amazing job explaining to this perfectly what these things mean, or you all confused and don't know what to ask. Either way, we're moving on. Look at chapter 6, beginning verse 1. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. Now, I want you to notice here, we talk about words that keep coming up. A couple weeks ago, we talked about the word better kept coming up. Better, better, better. Which gives you a kind of an understanding about how the book of Ecclesiastes is written and how you should read it. What we said about that, better is a relative term. So he says, when he says there is nothing better for a man to enjoy his labor and eat and drink and be happy in life, and so I ask the question, is heaven not better than life? Well, heaven is better than life. But what he's talking about, it's better to do that than to do what he had just been describing in the previous verses. So it's relative. Better than this thing. Better than those things. There's another word here that you see keep popping up, and the word is evil. You look at what it says here in verse 1. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun. And he says in verse 13 of chapter 5, look at chapter 5, verse 13, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun. What is that? Riches kept for their owners to his hurt. Wrong attitude about his riches, all right? And so here now he talks about another evil. So when the word evil is used in this context, what is he talking about? Okay, it's the word evil there is used, but he's not talking about it in the sense that that somebody's committing sin against God or there's a wickedness as defined against standard behavior, but he's talking about something that is a tragic thing for a man to go through. That's right. Yeah, it's tragic circumstances. That's right. It's tragic circumstances. So he's talking about what are the tragic circumstances that he's talking about here? That's common among men, he says, who live under the sun. Well, look at verse. No, let me ask you a question. Before I read the next verses, let me give you a scenario. If somebody said to you, somebody said, Dwayne, you're going to be a wealthy man and have plenty. You're going to have a lot of wonderful children, and you're going to live a long, long time. they told you that when you're 17 years old, what would you think they'd be describing for you? A great life, right? Me too, right? So if somebody said you're gonna be a wealthy man, you're going to have a lot of wonderful children, you're going to live a long time, what else could a man ask for? Now, my question is that a description of a happy life? Well, do you know any wealthy people with a lot of children who are really old who are not too happy? You know, think about that. Think about that just a moment. You're going to live a long time. He's going to describe for you a man who's going to live a long time, have a lot of kids, and a lot of wealth. But I want you to notice what he says about it. Look at what he says here beginning in verse 2. Hey, there you go. That's a good one. He had a lot of kids, didn't he? Lived a long time, have a lot of money. Spent a lot of time on the run, didn't he? All right, very good. That's a good point. All right, look at verse 2. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so he lacks nothing for himself of all that he desires. Now, stop there. We'll come back. Look at verse 3. If a man begets 100 children and live many years so that the days of his years are many, stop there. We'll come back. Look at verse 6. And if that man lives, or even if he lives 1,000 years twice, so you think about that. A man who lives 1,000 years twice, who has riches, wealth, and honor, and has 100 children. I'm going to suggest to you he's probably got more than one wife if he's got 100 children. There ain't no one woman going to put up with that. Obviously, he's using a figure of speech or hyperbole. Because in the context of the Old Testament, he's describing things that was the pinnacle of what you could achieve in the Old Testament. Wealth, a lot of children, and long life. Because those things were rare in the time in which they lived. It's hard to have a lot of children and have a happy situation. But they had a lot of children in the ancient days. Even like my mother's family, they had 13 kids. Or as my granny used to say, 13 cotton pickers. That's what they, anyway, that's kind of the goal there, I guess. But it was a blessing in those circumstances to have more children. You had more help at home. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But let's finish the sentences. Go back to verse 2. A man to whom God gives riches, wealth, and honor, so he lacks nothing for himself of all desires, yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, an evil affliction. And if a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so that all the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. For it comes in vanity and departs in darkness. Its name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun, known anything, this has more rest than that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice, but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place. All right, let's stop here and let's think about kind of what he's describing here. He's describing someone who on the surface has everything that, particularly to think back in their generations, of what you would desire to have. Wealth, honor, riches, very hard to get for the common person, the average person back in the days of the Old Testament, especially. And then the second thing that was thought of to be such a blessing to have in Old Testament life or ancient days is a lot of children. Hold your place here. Turn over to, where do I want to go? The psalmist and the proverb writer speaks about the blessing of children. Is that Psalms 27? That's what I get for trying to think on the fly here, Brother Joe. It's Proverbs 27, I think, isn't it? Somebody Google that. Happy is the man whose quiver is full. Is it 27:3? No, I don't know where it is. Somebody will tell me in a minute. Happy is the man whose quiver is full. You got it yet? I'll get y'all's devices out. Well, anyway, happy is the man whose quiver is full. So in that sense, he's talking about children. Now, who totes a quiver? Huh? That's what I thought, 127. I had the 2 and the 7, and I didn't carry my 1, Brother Darrell. Had the same problem in Miss Washington's math class in 1985. Carry your 1. Psalms 127, what verse is it? Start in verse 3 and read that, somebody. Anybody? Sam, you got it? What does it say? Okay. How is it that children can be described as arrows in the hand of a warrior? Children, huh? What's arrows in the hand of a warrior? A weapon, Kimbo. That's right. A weapon. Well, obviously, children can be a weapon, can't they? But that's not what he's talking about. How are children like? How is children to their parents like arrows to a man who's a warrior? A warrior with no arrows, he's in bad shape. You know, he's out of arrows. He's in bad shape. So how is it a warrior? How is children like that for people? All right, they're a blessing. They're needed. They're useful. They're helpful. Now, again, you think more in terms of the days in which these folks lived. There's a multitude of reasons why having a lot of children would be a blessing to a family, of what they one day may be able to help produce and help take care of the family, help provide when those circumstances may come. And so that can be a great blessing. That's how he describes it here. What about grandchildren? Are they a blessing? Oh, Sam, don't go. Get out your billfold. Show us your picture, Sam. Yep, you give them a Mountain Dew and chocolate and say, there you go. I don't know about these grandchildren. I hope they better. Anyway, Proverbs chapter 17. I'm all mixed up on my. Proverbs chapter 17. Look at what it says in verse 6. Children's children, that's grandchildren. Children's children are the crown of old men. The glory of children is their father. So he talks about the blessing of having grandchildren. And again, I think in the days in which these things take place, in the ancient world, you're talking about having blessing because your family is large in number and increased. You have just more help with whatever the family may endure or what they may go through. And then let me give you one more passage that goes along with the section here in Ecclesiastes. Look at Proverbs chapter 3. Here he talks about long life. Proverbs chapter 3, my son, do not forget my law, but let your heart keep my commands. For length of days and long life and peace they will add to you. So everybody in the day in which they live, the thing you would aspire to have as part of your life is wealth, riches, honor, a lot of kids, and live a long time. And yet he describes a scenario where that doesn't completely satisfy. And the reason, if you go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 6, is because he talks about, one, he got a lot of stuff, but a foreigner consumes it. Verse 2, and then he says, he lives in many years, begets 100 children, lives many years, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness. He's not happy. You can't make him happy. He doesn't appreciate that. And even he lives 1,000 years twice and has not seen goodness. He's not happy. But look at how verse 6 ends. There's this common theme that he comes back to over and over again, is that there's a great equalizing sorrow that every man must deal with, and that is this: do not all go to one place. What is he describing? Do all go to heaven? Do all go to hell? Well, how is it everybody goes to one place? What one place is he talking about? The grave. Very good. That's right. The grave. Now, again, in the Old Testament, they have a very murky view of the afterlife. There is some mention of the afterlife in the Old Testament, certainly, of resurrection. Job talks about that. But there's not the kind of teaching and instruction about the afterlife that there is in the New Testament, about resurrection and those things and how it transpires, what God's plan is for all that. And so there was kind of a murky view about exactly what happens. That's why he says here, he'll say in the book of Ecclesiastes, the living know they shall die, but the dead know not nothing. Well, the, the rich man Lazarus, you know, Lazarus knew something after he was dead. He knew not to, he didn't want his brothers to come to the place where he was. And so those are not absolute defining moments about what happens when you die. But they had a limited view about the afterlife. So death was seen as the great equalizer of all men. All go to the same place. All go to the grave. So if a man's rich and has a lot of kids, if he lives 2,000 years, he's still going to die and go to the place that the man who wasn't rich, who didn't have a lot of kids and didn't live a long time, goes. And so what benefited is all those things? Here's a strange thing. He says in verse 3 that a man lives 100 years, begets 100 children, lives many years, and the days of years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness. And this, and indeed he has no burial. What is that about having no burial would be described as a circumstance somebody may run into that would make them their meaning of their life be so tragic? Nobody buried you. Nobody buried you. You know, again, in the Old Testament, burial was such an important thing. Do y'all remember the first piece of ground that Abraham ever received in the Promised Land, what it was? A burial place for Sarah. Place to bury his wife. Place to bury. When the children of Israel, in the book of Hebrews, Joseph is mentioned as one of those examples of faith. You know, you have all those great examples of faith, right? Abel, Moses, Enoch, all those great examples of faith and what they did. Great things they did. Abel by faith offered a more great sacrifice. Moses by faith. Noah by faith did these great things, right? Abraham by faith, when he was called, went. These tremendous things. And what it says about Joseph, when it talks about his faith, it says, and Joseph by faith made mention of his bones. That's the part of his faith that's mentioned in Hebrews. Not the time he spent in Potiphar's house, not being in that pit, not being sold into slavery, not the story of the coat of many colors, not being in charge and saving his family from famine. When he said, you meant it for evil, God meant it for good. The story that's mentioned in Hebrews to highlight his faith was that he made mention, when he was dying, he made mention of his bones. What did he say about his bones? Do not leave them here. Don't leave them here. When you leave here, take my bones with you. I want to be buried in the Promised Land. Yes. Yeah. That's why it's an example of faith. He saw it way off, didn't he? He saw it way off. He believed the promises of God. And having not seen it, he believed it as though he did see it. Right. Yeah. Well, Oh, yeah. Hey, well, go read the story when Jacob died and the funeral procession they gave Jacob. The funeral procession they gave. It's a pretty powerful picture if you think about all that was involved in them toting his body to the place it was buried. So I think it's right to honor that, certainly. They were very careful about the way they did it in the New Testament with the body of Jesus and those type things. But again, I think the principal point is, I think Sam is right. Why would this be such a tragedy? When it says he has no burial, I think the primary reason is because he had all his kids and they didn't love him enough to give him a proper burial. He didn't have a good relationship with them enough to give him a proper burial. That's sad. That's sad. I did a funeral years ago for a man who died. He was my dad's next door neighbor and he passed away. And he had daughters who he was estranged from. They didn't come to the funeral. He had one grandson who's a state police officer in Kansas, and he seemed like a good guy. I talked to him a couple times on the phone, and because my dad had said, you know, we got to help this guy, help bury him. You know, we need to do something, and so his grandson called me, or I called him one and talked to him about it, and he said, just handle it whatever how you want to handle it. We're not going to be there, and he said, you do what you think you need to do. It'll be fine. Whatever you decide to do. And nobody, never, he had no family there. There was a few neighbors there, some people he used to work with there. But none of his family came. And it was just a sad situation. I got a card in the mail a few days later from that grandson, you know, thanking him for my help. And he sent me $100. And which I didn't need the money, didn't want the money, never asked for the money. But that was his contribution to his grandfather. And it's just, it was sad to me, heartbreaking to me, that he had nobody, that was it, that they done their part, you know. So I think that's what he's describing here. And he says, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. How is a stillborn child better than the man who lived his life with a lot of kids in a long time but had no burial? It's a very painful thing anytime you involve children, any kind of sickness or anything like that, but especially death. But the idea of a stillborn child, you know, for a child to be stillborn means you went through the whole process, you gave birth to it. And all the pain and suffering that goes along with the birth process for the woman, you did all of that. And at the end of the day, all that time, that energy, that effort, that birth process, the baby died. It was born that way. And see, he's describing a very dark picture here of the pain of this kind of man. The one who doesn't see goodness in what he has no good relationship with anybody that would bury him, though he have 100 children. And his wealth, he never enjoyed that, appreciated that like he should. He had a wrong attitude about it. And the fact he lived a long time didn't turn out to be a blessing. He'd been better off. He will feel worse than someone who's lost a child at birth, like he describes it. It's worse for him than people who go through this. Describing a very dark picture. All right, any questions or comments about this section? Anyone has? All right, putting them up, setting them down. Let's pick up verse 7. And I know the bell will ring here in just a minute. We'll read ahead here. Verse 7. All the labor of a man is for his youth. Excuse me, for his mouth. These new glasses. These super duper glasses. Let me get it away from you so I can see it. All the labor of a man is for his mouth. Yet the soul is not satisfied. For what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity, grasping for wind. Whatever one is, he has been named already. For it is known that he is man. He cannot contend with him who is mightier than he. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? For who knows what is good for man in life? All the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow. Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? Now, you know, he's kind of talked himself back into a bad state here. Very, very negative language about the circumstances of man here on this earth, and what he puts himself through just to live here, and for what? Well, again, in this section here, verses 7, going through the end of the chapter, who's missing? God's missing. So I just want you to see that. You go back and start reading chapter 1 and read through these things that he's trying to find meaning. When he tries it by himself, talking to himself, you see him do this. He talks to himself through what he's seeing and witnessing the world, and what's happening in life, and he's so down about the world that he lives in. When he introduces God, he feels so much better about his purpose, why he's here. He finds meaning to his life. And so will you. All right, we'll pick up there next Wednesday night, Lord willing. Thank y'all.